Welcome to the Versus History Podcast with your hosts, Patrick O'Shaughnessy, Connell Smith, and Elliot Watson.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this episode of Versus History, the podcast. It's me, your host, as always, Patrick O'Shaughnessy, at History Chappie, if you are au fait with social media. And today, for the Versus History Podcast, we are joined by the host and the editor and the creator of a fabulous podcast. Her name is Marion Jones, and her podcast is the City Breaks podcast. Now, I don't want to say too much about it because I won't do as good a job as Marion, but Marion, welcome to Versus History. It's a delight to have you with us.
And it's a delight to be here. Thank you.
We're very, very grateful. I know, being a podcaster myself, obviously how much time it takes off your hands and then coming on other people's podcasts, still more, but we're very, very grateful. And I think having lived through the pandemic, and travel is one of my penchants, it's the pandemic has made travel very, very difficult, but your podcast gives people hope. And also it's something to look forward to. And also, the content you're delivering is absolutely outstanding. So what I will say, Marion, is could you just tell us a little bit about yourself and why you started City Breaks podcast? And as importantly, what is the City Breaks podcast all about? Over to you.
Okay. Well, to introduce myself, I'm just an ex-language teacher. I retired about 6 months ago from teaching French and German. And that, I think, is the starting point, really. I love languages. I've done lots and lots of trips with students to France, Germany, Austria, lots of trips without students too. I'm also a podcast listener. So I put all that together and I thought, when I go somewhere, I always think that I'm going to do some research and find out the history before I go and really know what I'm looking at. And actually, do you know what? I don't always get around to it. And so I thought, well, a podcast that did that for you might be quite good. So that's
absolutely
the plan.
Absolutely.
And I take one city at a time. So I've done 9 so far, and they have quite a lot of episodes. So there might be 15 or 20 episodes on, say, Paris or London, or in our case, Florence, we're going to talk about in a minute. And most episodes are about places that you're probably going to go and visit. And it gives you a little bit of the history and the stories attached to that place, so that when you get there, you really do know what you're looking at.
And listeners, please take my advice before we go any further. Subscribe to the City Breaks podcast. It is absolutely fantastic. And you might have already had a taste of it, because Marion wrote a blog post for us on Dante and Florence. So read that whilst you're at it. Okay, then. So the first question, I suppose, then, is how is that Dante piece you wrote for the blog, the Versus History blog post? How is it typical of the City Breaks approach?
Well, most of my episodes are either a place that you might be visiting, a museum, a cathedral, a castle, whatever, and then the stories behind it, or sometimes the other way around, a person that's really important to the place that you're visiting. So when I did my series on Florence, Dante was one of those people, along with, let's say, Galileo, the scientist, and Machiavelli, and one or two others. And I thought they were so important, and it's so good to know a bit about them, that I did it the other way around. So those episodes are a little bit of a biography of that person, and advice on where can you find them in the city today? Where did they live? What statues are there to them? Can you see their science in the science museum, etc.? So that's the plan. So it's one of the sort of two types that I do.
Fantastic. Okay, a curveball for you then, Marion, given your penchant and your passion for Italian history. Let's say we are in the UK, or perhaps even the United States, and we want to sample some Italian culture or Italian food or Italian music from the comfort of our own home, which the pandemic has made all the more important and all the more essential. What would you recommend? Do you have any particular Italian restaurants that you love, or Italian music that you love, or Italian literature? What would you recommend to our listeners if they wanted an hors d'oeuvre?
Oh, well, I'm sure everybody's au fait with Italian food. You can always get pizza in, can't you? Or you can have a gelato. That's ice cream for anyone who doesn't speak Italian. You can cook your own pasta. Lots of possibilities there. I don't think in England we're that good at Italian culture in other forms, actually. Obviously, if you're an opera goer, you can go and see some Verdi, listen to some Verdi. Reading-wise, there aren't many Italian authors, are there, that we read? There's a recent one, Elena Ferranti, who's written a whole series of novels based in Naples, but I don't know those that well. I'll give you a cheat. When I was researching this series, the one on Florence, I found a couple of books that are in English set in Florence, actually more than that, several books, which I really, really enjoyed. So if you want to read about being a tourist in Florence, why don't you go for E.M. Forster's A Room with a View, which only the first half is set in Florence, actually. The second half is in England, but you can watch some Victorians going to various places in Florence that you can still visit today and get their take on it. So that would be one recommendation. And another book that I absolutely loved and had not heard about, I just Googled books about Florence, I think, and up it came. And it's called The Birth of Venus by Sarah Ginant. And she went to Florence, was in one of the cathedrals, and saw a painting and was really intrigued by it, particularly by one girl who wasn't the main person in it at all. She was just off to a corner somewhere. And she went home, would you believe it, and wrote a novel imagining this girl's life. And it's set in 15th century Florence. The girl, I don't want to give any plot spoilers, but she's married off fairly young by her parents to somebody who turns out to be, let's say, highly unsuitable. And the rest of the story is about how she copes with that, what she does about it. So it's quite interesting on a human level, but it's set in the cloth dyeing area of Florence. So you get lots of stuff about what life was like then. You get descriptions of meals, you get a wedding banquet, you get all sorts of things. I would say start there and read that. And when you've enjoyed that, see if Sarah Ginant wrote anything else, because that was just so good. You'd have to go for it if she has.
Thank you very much, Marion. Okay, I'm going to pose a scenario to you now. Let's say some of our listeners, or perhaps me, we're on the way to Florence and we want to really immerse and indulge ourselves in some of the history and the sights and the sounds and the scenes. If you could pick perhaps 2 to 4 places that we should visit and tell us a little bit about the history behind them. And you can go anywhere you want to go in Florence. It could be human history, natural history, wherever you want. So you're basically imagining that you are our virtual tour guide. Take us on a tour of Florence. But if you could start by telling us exactly where it is in Italy so we can orientate ourselves in the geography before we get into these fantastic sights and scenes. Over to you.
Okay, Florence in Tuscany, northern Italy. I think that's probably all I need to say, isn't it? It's got an airport. That's handy. Easy to go.
There you go. Absolutely fantastic. Short and sweet. Now tell us, where should we go?
Well, if you're on a first visit and perhaps you're not going for very long, I think the most iconic place would be the one that if you've seen any pictures of Florence ever, it's going to be the cathedral. I don't know if you can picture that lovely terracotta dome and then the marble building underneath the green and white facade. So you've got to start there, haven't you, really? So let's go to the cathedral square. And you might already be thinking, oh, I get dragged around a lot of cathedrals. You know, is it really important to see this one? I'd say, yes, it is. And it's going to be 10 times more interesting if you know a couple of the stories behind it when you get there. So we're in the square. We're going to go in through the main cathedral door. And actually, no, we're not. We're going to stop in the square a minute and just gaze up at that beautiful roof and think, how did that get there? That looks difficult. And then you can take yourself back to the 15th century when it was being finished and think that actually that's exactly what the people in Florence were saying. We've built this marvellous building so far. Look at those walls. Look at the art that's inside. My goodness, we haven't got a roof. And that's going to be tricky because a roof's going to be very heavy to sit on top. And we're in the 15th century, architecture, engineering wasn't what it is today. What are we going to do? So they had a competition. Let's get anyone who thinks they can manage it to give us their design, and then we'll look at them all and pick one.
And, oh, wow. That sounds like a recipe for disaster, but was it?
Well, you see, the person who came along, actually, the one who got the contract, tricked his way into it. There were 19 designs in this competition, and we're talking about Filippo Brunelleschi was his name. He wanted to be the winner, so he goes along to the judging meeting and doesn't bring his design, and others are looked at and he criticizes them all, and then he says, I've got an idea, here's a little puzzle. Everybody's got to have an egg, And the person who can make the egg balance on a flat surface without holding it or propping it up in any way is showing that they have the know-how to build the roof that we need. So everyone else tries, they can't do it. He comes along and he gets a little, I don't know, some metal implement or other, and he tapped the bottom of the egg a little bit and flattened it. So, of course, it sat on the table. And everyone else said, yeah, well, anyone could have done that. And he said, because he was very arrogant, he said, well, clearly anyone could do it, but only I would think of it. And that's why you need me to design the roof. And I just like that story, because it's just all the arrogance of the man, really. Anyway, so he won. He started designing it. And actually, there was a but, because the committee appointed him and they said, look, we're a bit nervous about this. We'd like you to have a sidekick, a person to help you. So that's what's going to happen. Now, Brunelleschi didn't like that either. So he comes up with trick number two, which is they go on for a bit and the roof is started and he talks about the design he wants and everything. And then he went to bed for a week and said, I'm sorry, I'm too ill to work. You just have to carry on without me. And the other man didn't actually know what to do next. So no work was done. So after a week or so, the committee come back to Brunelleschi and say, this man says he can't manage without you. And he says, yeah, well, I'd do that. And I'm not doing it with him. It's either me on my own or nobody. So they were forced to agree to that. So you've heard his name, you know, all down the centuries. That's how he tricked his way into doing it. Do you want to hear about a murder story?
Oh, absolutely. Never say no to that.
Okay. So this is the big story, really, for the cathedral. So when you go in, if you're standing as near as you can get to the altar and just looking at the scene, what you really need to know is that there was a murder committed there in, I think it was 1478. One family of bankers were having a feud with a different family of bankers, and they decided they would settle it by murdering the sons, the next generation of the family they didn't like.
As you do.
So, well, yes, quite. This is how I think knowing this story is interesting, but it also tells you what Florence in the 15th century was like, you know, these rival factions and the violence and it's horrendous, really, but it does make, you know, quite a juicy story to think about when you go and visit. So you may have heard of, do you know the Medici family? Have you heard of them?
Yes, we've had a couple of podcasts on them before. Charles Freeman talked at length about them. So our listeners, if they've been listening to the back catalogue, will know their stuff. But please carry on.
Okay, well, I need to go and find those episodes by the sound of it. Anyway, the Medici family had two sons, Lorenzo and Giuliano. They were going to be the next generation, and they were the biggest, wealthiest banking family, closely followed by the Pazzi family, who had decided this was the solution to the problem. So can you believe they got some thugs together? They got two priests who agreed to help. The priests hid daggers underneath their robes. This is all on Easter Sunday in 1478. And they had decided at the moment of the service when the priest lifts the host. So when he's just blessing the bread, if you like, for the service, that was the signal for the murderers. And sure enough, when the priest did raise the host, the two priests got the daggers out from under their cloaks and set about the Medici brothers. One of them was murdered very brutally, stabbed in the head, in fact. The other one was a bit luckier. He had a group of friends around him and they quickly worked out what was happening and they hustled him into a side room and locked the door. A little detail that I read that's interesting but gory was that one of his friends sucked the blood out of the wounds on his leg because he knew that the chances were the dagger had been poisoned as well as stabbing him. They were trying to poison him. So he survived. So knowing all that, you know, when you go and look at the cathedral, I think it's just interesting to stand there and think this happened, you know, 600 years ago.
Please tell us more. So the next place after the cathedral, where would we go next?
Well, Patrick, I'll give you a choice. Do you fancy going to a palace or do you fancy... Okay. We've got a couple of palaces on offer. What about, do you want the one that set the whole town talking about how splendid it was?
can't say no to that. Let's go there. No.
Okay, well, this is called the Palazzo Medici Riccardi. So in fact, it was owned by two families, but the famous Medici were the first lot. They had it built. So they were in the second or third generation of banking, and they'd made a huge pile and they decided to build a palace. And this is Cosimo de' Medici. And when you go to it today, it's actually very plain and simple. It's just two stone walls along the two roads that it's that cross over where it's built. And then when you go through, it opens up into the most fantastic palace with a courtyard. They used to ride their horses straight into it. It's got arches. It's got the gold and red Medici coat of arms everywhere. And you think, wow, I didn't expect all this splendor from what I saw outside. And there's a reason for that. So I don't know if any of the listeners know any bankers, but bankers are often pretty well off, aren't they?
Indeed.
And there's a bit of a thing that other people think, I wonder where they got all that money. You know, is some of it ill-gotten gains? Is some of that money really ours or whatever? And Cosimo de' Medici knew this. And so he decided he would build a palace that looked like not much on the outside so that the whole town wouldn't be saying, where did he get his money from? But inside it would be splendid enough to impress his guests. And the thing I really like about this is the actual quotation of what he said. Apparently he was explaining, you know, you don't want to make everyone jealous. It'll just cause trouble. And what he said was, envy is a plant one should never water.
Absolutely. Never a truer word said.
There you go. So when you go in, there's all this splendor and there are all sorts of things. On my podcast, I make a bit of a habit of not just listing all the paintings and statues in every building, because frankly, how dull is that? So can I pick out one piece of art that's in there to tell you about, maybe?
Absolutely. Go for it.
Okay, we'll go past the statues, past the paintings on the walls, up the stairs into the family chapel. Okay, now that's a smallish room with just two or three little pews for a small collection of Medici. There were actually 50 of them living in this palace, but I think they collected in smaller numbers in the chapel. And as soon as you walk in, you will be amazed, because it's tiny, but on three of the four walls, there is the most fantastic fresco in beautiful golds and pinks and blues and just lovely colours. And you just feel surrounded by it. And it's a very interesting picture. It's called The Procession of the Magi being the three kings, of course, in the Bethlehem story. And the Medici had it commissioned to impress their visitors and whatnot. And I don't know if they asked or whether the artist was just sort of sucking up to them. But anyway, the end result is that if you lived in Florence in those times when it was painted, you would know that the faces of all the main characters, so the kings and the person leading the procession, were in fact the Medici family. They had themselves put into the story. How arrogant is that?
Very much full of themselves, so it sounds.
That just tells you a little bit about, you know, what they were trying to do, the lengths they would go to impress people, if you like. But in fact, they didn't get it quite right, because they had it set in sort of Tuscan hills. So they wanted it to look like their home and have them in it. So, of course, other people looking at it think, hang on a minute, that's not, Palestine. Anyway, OK, so that's that. Where else can I take you? Well, we've been to the Cathedral Square.
We have.
That's actually only the second biggest square in Florence, because the bigger one is called the Piazza, that means square, della Signoria. And the Signoria was the ruling council of the city in medieval times. So the government, the seat of government, if you like. So one square's got the church and all of that in it. And the other one is where the power really was, I suppose, in the Signoria. Lots of things have happened there. What can I tell you? Okay. Have you heard of something called the Bonfire of the Vanities?
I haven't. Obviously, I've heard, like most English folk, of Bonfire Night, but never of the Bonfire of the Vanities. So tell us more, Marion. Right.
Okay. I should have looked this up before I started, but I haven't. There's actually an American novel. I think it's by an American writer called The Bonfire of the Vanities. So anybody who's interested can go and find out what that's about. Anyway, this is the real bonfire that took place in 1498, another scary story, which gives you a picture of Florence being a very religious centre, but with a lot of bad things going on as well, if you like. So they have this one mad, really very extreme priest called Savonarola, who was one of those priests who would fill the cathedral and then talk at length about hell and damnation and how evil everybody was and the wickedness of modern life and everything. This is back in the 15th century.
He sounds like a 16th century Puritan or a 17th century Puritan.
Well, it's linked, or it's of that ilk, yes. And he collected, but he went further than most. He collected bands of young people who he persuaded to agree with him, and they would go processing down the streets. They wore white, they were singing hymns, there were trumpets sounding, there were bells, they carried olive branches, you know, it was a real event. And what they were doing was they were going and knocking on doors and telling people that they had to give them anything that the priest didn't approve of. And there's a whole massive list of things, but, you know, nice clothes, books he didn't agree with, portraits, mirrors, because that was vain to want to see yourself in a mirror, jewellery, I mean, just all sorts of stuff. And a huge collection was made, and he had it all piled up in this square that you can go and visit and set fire to, because he said, you shouldn't be thinking about these things. And the end of that story is, after a while, some people began to think, hang on, why are we doing everything this man says? You know, there was a faction against him, if you like. And long story short, he was arrested. He himself then, I think there was a sort of a trial, but everyone knew what the outcome was going to be. And he was dragged to the same square, and he was tortured and executed and then burnt. That was a second bonfire. But the bonfire of the vanities was the big one, with all the things that he thought were vain, mirrors, clothes, etc., just all disappeared. So when you go today, you can find the plaque in the square and stand on it, and it's got the date 1498, and it's got his name, and you can think of that story. What else can I tell you? Would you like to hear about my favorite building?
Absolutely. How can I say no? Your stage is yours.
Okay. So this is it's going to sound dull, but bear with me. It's called San Marco, which means St. Mark's, and it's a monastery. And so why is it my favourite? OK, well, first of all, it's just absolutely beautiful. So you go in, there's a courtyard, sort of greenery in the middle, and then cloisters all the way around, and archways, and a huge medieval refectory, and just a lovely atmosphere. And it's famous, really, if tourists go. Actually, that's one nice thing. It's much less busy than the cathedral or the big art galleries. But the people who do make it there are looking for the frescoes, because when it was built, it was paid for actually by one of the Medici bankers. And everybody said at the time, oh, are you feeling guilty? Are you, you know, trying to get back on the right side of God because you've cheated us all? And this is what you're doing with some of your money. I don't know whether that was it or not, whether he was perhaps a religious man too. I don't know. Anyway, he had this built, and he engaged two very well-known artists to paint frescoes on the walls. So when you go, you've got this lovely downstairs bit with the courtyard and everything. Then you go upstairs and you can walk around three sides of the building. And there are all these, they call them cells, which makes it sound like a prison, but they were the rooms that the monks had. And each one is quite tiny, plain coloured walls. And on each one, he got one of these wonderful artists to paint a fresco. And it's just room after room with the most glorious paintings of sort of lovely colours. And they're all religious in theme, of course, but it's just a very quiet sort of reflective place that you can just wander around and really get a sense of what it must have been like to live in that century. And one detail that struck me was there are 43 of these cells, I think, and seven of them are slightly bigger than the others. The reason being, they were for the novice monks. So when people arrived from normal life and said, yes, I think I'm up for this, I want to be a monk, they thought it was too much of a shock to lock them away in a tiny room. So they gave them a slightly bigger room for the first year or so until they got used to it. And then they moved them into the smaller ones.
Wow.
And there as well. Also there, I forgot to mention, there's a library. Now, this is billed as, I don't know if it's true, because you read these things in guidebooks and you think, are they making it up? Anyway, they say they think it was Europe's first ever lending library, because one of the Medici, with some of this spare cash, a lot of the Medici were very into arts and literature and all sorts, and he bought a huge collection of books and stored them here in this monastery. And it was the monk's scriptorium as well. So it was where they used to sit. You know, those illuminated manuscripts with the beautiful pictures often on the first letter on the page.
Absolutely.
Well, this is what they were doing there. And so on that room, you can go around and look at some of their work, which they've still got, and you can look at displays explaining how they did it, how they made the different colours, you know, in the days when you couldn't just go to the art shop and buy a paint box. You know, they had to make those beautiful blues and reds and everything, and it tells you exactly how they did it. And then you can see the pens and the quills that they used to do it with. So I'd go to San Marco if I went back.
Well, that is some historical exploration of Florence. Wow. Absolutely blown away by that, Marion. Absolutely fantastic. Thank you for sharing that with us. Okay, I suppose that leads me on to the next and possibly the last question for you. I mean, you say you're not really a historian, although you've done a fantastic job of being just that. So how on earth do you go about researching all the information that you need for the City Breaks podcast series, which is crammed with information, anecdotes and shibboleths and interesting bits and bobs and ditties? How do you go about doing that?
Well, that was my problem when I started. I thought, I would like to know all this. How am I going to find out? I start usually with a guidebook to the city. So I buy a rough guide or a Lonely Planet or something, and I read that. And actually, both of those, I think, have extra further reading suggestions in them. So that's a good start. For the Florence series, I usually try and get one or two, as far as I can tell, not really being a historian, sort of high quality books to start me off. And in this instance, I got a book called Florence, the Biography of a City by Christopher Hibbert, who's written all sorts of amazing history books. And that was sort of from the year dot right up to 1966. He stopped there because that was a key year in Florence when the city was flooded. And I think the book was published probably 20 years ago. Anyway, so I started with that. And then I got two or three other actual history books. So in this case, I read actually two different books on the Medici. They're quite a popular topic, I think, for historians. And I found two different ones. That's a good idea, actually, to read two books on the same topic, because then you start thinking, hang on, some of this is they agree on, and other things, this said one thing and the other one. So you start thinking a bit more like a historian, I think. I got, in this case, quite a lot of art books. So, you know, Michelangelo or other artists. And I read some biographies. So I read a biography of Michelangelo, for example, that we've mentioned. And I've got a couple of sort of tips that have worked for me. So there's a really good series of books called A Traveller's Reader, and they happen to have done one on Florence. And what that is, it's an anthology. So it's a collection of extracts. And I haven't got it in front of me, so I can't be sure, but over centuries, I mean, certainly as early as sort of the 1400s, there'll be things that were written then right up to the current day. So that sometimes I use something from one of the extracts for my podcast. And sometimes I just think that sounds like a book I need to read. So I've got the author, I've got the title, I order it from the library and have it sent along and see what I think. I read, because I know historians always talk about primary sources, don't they? And I'm not really, I mean, The Traveller's Reader is kind of a collection of primary sources, really. Someone else has done the looking, but it's quite close, I think. But for this series, I did read one actual primary source, because I kept reading about this book called Lives of the Artists by someone called Giorgio Vasari. And it was published, well, I'll go on, Patrick, you guess, when do you think it was published?
Wow, you put me on the spot here. I'm going to go for shot in the dark. I'm going to go for the end of the 7 years of French and Indian War, 1763. How far off am I?
Well, you probably think you've gone back a long way, but actually 1550. So this man was an artist
miles
himself.
Off. And absolutely miles off.
So he was actually at the time, if you like, the time I'm talking about. He was an artist himself, so he knew all the artists. He moved in those circles, and he was a bit of a gossip as well. And he liked to write little pieces about them, and that you can get this book from any library. You can certainly order it from a library. And read it today. So you get Giorgio Vasari on Michelangelo's fight when he got his nose broken by another artist that he'd fallen out with, et cetera, et cetera. So I read that. And actually, once I've read some proper history books and I've got the sort of timeline in my head, and I think I'm not going to make too many crass errors. Actually, I'm very interested in literature as well. So, as I mentioned earlier, I read A Room with a View and The Birth of Venus. I'm just seeing if I've got anything else on my list. Oh, yes, I read a wonderful book by someone called Irving Stone called The Agony and the Ecstasy. And what that is a slightly fictionalized biography of Michelangelo. And I mean, scenes in that just stick in your head. So, for example, this when he was a young boy, he was so into art. It's all he wanted to do. And so there were descriptions of him working hard all day and then going to bed. He lived in his employer's house until everyone else was asleep, and then getting up in the middle of the night and creeping out to the mortuary because he wanted to know how to paint and draw the human body. So he spent his nights sitting in the mortuary practicing, drawing people, for instance. So sort of one book leads to another, I suppose. You know, you sort of read a lovely novel like The Birth of Venus, and you think, what else did that author write? And you go and have a look. Absolutely. And then eventually I think I've got loads of stuff now, because the research is very interesting. And at some point you have to stop and say, right, how am I going to use this? And then I start writing the episodes. Does that answer your question?
Fully and thoroughly. How can we go about interacting with you? Are you on social media? Remind us of the name of the podcast. Tell us everything. Let's say we want more, and who wouldn't? How do we go about doing that?
Okay. Well, I suppose the podcast is called City Breaks, two words. The website is the place where you can find all the different series. So you might like The Sound of Florence, or you might think, oh, St. Petersburg or Paris, or there are nine different cities. Go find. So the website address is www. Then all written as one word, citybreakspodcast.co.uk. And I am on Twitter as well, and I'm forever forgetting I think the word is handle, isn't it? I'm not really a social media person, but I think it's called at City Breaks Cast. I think that's right. But if you go on and do the search thing and look for City Breaks, you'll find it. Yes, I think it's at City Breaks Cast. Yep.
We've had a few interviewees on talking about Italy and related things. You've had Jennifer Anton, who's a historical novelist, who penned the fabulous book Under the Light of the Italian Moon. So if I were going to Florence, I would take that with me. I would also take the work by Professor Victoria De Grazia of Columbia University. And Dr. Dave Brown has done a couple of podcasts on Mussolini. So not directly related to the topic you've talked about, but would certainly help colour in the picture of Italy and its broad and wonderful landscape and people.
I heard the word Mussolini, and that reminds me that in a later episode, there is, because we've talked about the medieval Florence, really, but I've been through other episodes as well. There is a wonderful description in one of the books I read about Mussolini showing, wait for it, Hitler round Florence. So the two of them went on a car ride through, open top car, through the city, and the residents had all been given flags and, you know, things to welcome them with. And they did all the main sites, and then they went to the opera. I think that's right. And then they signed a treaty agreeing to agree with each other forevermore or something. So, yes. Sorry, I interrupted you.
No, I think I've used that very shot. I've used a shot of Hitler and Mussolini in an open top car to promote the very podcast I was talking about, Dr. Dave Brown, but I never knew where the picture was from. So you've just helped me out there. I can't thank you enough for coming on to the Versus History podcast and sharing your wisdom, expertise, and knowledge about travel generally, but also Florence in particular. So I'm very, very grateful. Even Siri was trying to jump in there. Apologies for that. And wish you every success with the podcast. Look, it's a brilliant podcast, guys. And if you haven't already read the blog on Dante's Florence, please do head over to versusissue.com. But also, more importantly, head over to City Breaks podcast, where there's lots more podcasts and articles there as well. So, Marion, look, we can't thank you enough, as I've said, for coming on Versus History. Thank you so much for sharing your time and expertise with us. We hope to have you back again very soon.
I hope so too. It's been an absolute delight.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Versus History podcast. Visit us at www.versushistory.com and follow us at Versus History on Twitter and Instagram. You can download all episodes from iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or from wherever you get your podcasts.